Welcome back, everyone. We're about to start our panel, which will be moderated by Dr. Jeannie Hanley. Dr. Hanley is a physician who lives with cystic fibrosis. Although she had CF symptoms when she was young, she was not diagnosed until her early 30s after genetic testing became available. As an allergist at USC in Los Angeles, she spearheaded the implementation of a mobile allergy and asthma program for medically underserved children. She's dedicated to volunteering for CF organizations such as CF Roundtable, where she was president for 5 years, and with CFRI, where she serves on the board of directors and devotes time to committees involved in diversity and inclusion, research, advisory, and advocacy. Welcome, Dr. Hanley.
Thank you. Good evening, everybody. I'm so honored to moderate this panel discussion. In addition to Bijal Trivedi, author of The Powerful Breath from Salt, we have three panelists with us who've all played a role in Breath from Salt and are distinguished in their own right and due to their significant contributions to the field of CF and our community. So the first is Isabel Burns. She is a bereavement social worker at Mission Hospice in Redwood City, where she counsels and leads writing groups for those who are grieving. She's lived with CF for 48 years and received a double lung transplant in 2004. Isabel and her late twin Annabelle published the memoir, The Power of Two, and served as patient advocates in their mother's country, Japan, which led to the creation of a documentary film of the same title, Power of Two. Isa has lectured around the country on topics such as living well with illness, end of life issues, and organ donation, including a TEDx Stanford talk in 2014. Dr. Paul Quinton, who will be with us shortly, seminal cystic fibrosis research provided new understanding of the disease that had a game-changing impact on the field. Dr. Quinton, who has CF, discovered that the basic defect in the CF sweat duct was due to anion impermeability and not defective anion exchange. His discovery is considered one of the major advances in understanding the basic CF defect. Dr. Quinton has served as an inspiring mentor to countless others in the field. Dr. Jeff Wine is the Benjamin Scott Crocker Professor of Human Biology and Director of the Cystic Fibrosis Research Laboratory at Stanford University. His research in cystic fibrosis was sparked by his daughter's diagnosis with CF in 1981. Since 1987, Dr. Wine has studied genetic and cellular aspects of CF in humans and animal models to increase understanding of the disease in ways that have improved treatment. Dr. Wine and his colleagues identified the first heterozygote effect of the CFTR mutation, and his studies have been influential in helping find therapies for keeping CF lungs healthy. So welcome, Isa, Paul, and Jeff, and welcome back, Bijal. If we were here in person, I know that you would all receive a standing ovation, and I wish I could almost hear the thunderous applause myself. But thank you again for being on the panel today. So, Paul is not on here yet, but we'll have to deal with that. And hopefully he'll be here soon. So I want to start off with asking what interested each of you, Isa, Jeff, and I know Bijal, you kind of described this all, you described this about going about interviewing people, but what interested each of you to become part of the book and involved in this beautiful endeavor? I mean, what parts of the book hit home for you Did it reflect your CF experience or didn't? And I'll just start off with Isa.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Jeannie, for the lovely introduction. And it's an honor to be on this panel with the likes of Dr. Wine and Bijal and Dr. Quinton. So I was very grateful, and I just want to make a shout out of gratitude to Dr. Stephen Shack, who invented Pulmozyme, and I wouldn't be here without his work. And thank you, Bijal, for featuring the miracle of Pulmozyme, of DNase back in the day. And it was because of Dr. Shack, I believe he gave my name to Bijal. And so that's how you asked me if you'd like to interview a person who benefited from DNase. I think that was a couple of years ago. It was such a long time, I had actually forgotten about what would happen with that interview until he emailed me or texted me with great excitement when the book came out and said, I'm in it and you're in it. So that's how I reawakened this incredible awe of your work, Bijal. Thank you so much for writing this book.
Yeah. And Jeff, would you like to add how, what interested you in becoming involved with the book, or how did you get involved with it? Well, we know why, what you did, but yes.
Yeah, I wish Paul were here because my daughter's diagnosis got me into CF, but it was working with Paul that put me on the direct track, because in those days, really people didn't know what was going on with cystic fibrosis. With one exception, Paul had a clear, very clear idea of what was going on. And that proved to be the lodestar for my research. I'd like to back up. And again, thank you for a wonderful introduction. Thank Bijal for writing that book. Isa, what can I say? It's people like Isa who make it all worthwhile. So with particular regard to the book, the thing that I was telling Bijal before we went live, that for me, since I obviously knew a lot of the research, what really struck home were some of the accounts from parents before we had any of the insights that we have now. I also got that from Power of Two for sure. And the other thing, which might surprise some of you, was the terrific account of fundraising. Because doing science, doing research is actually fun. But for me, the thing that I least like to do is ask for money. And I saw these people going out and asking for money, and after somebody had given them millions of dollars, would go back and ask for more. That's almost incomprehensible to me how someone can do that. So seeing that whole process exposed was fascinating.
Thank you. I do want to just mention to the folks out there that you can chat put in the chat your questions. I am not seeing them if there are questions there. So, and this is for you all out there. So please, add them. So I guess the another question, and this is for all of you. I know, Bijal, you included so many different facets of subjects and people. And what did it make it? Is there something, and this is for all of you, didn't make it, or what would you like to see in Bijal's sequel, for example? what is going to, what should be there? What subjects or people? I mean, I know for me, there are so many clinicians who were so helpful with my diagnosis, who I wouldn't have gotten it so soon without them. Some of them were mentioned in the book, others were not. And you can't possibly hit on everybody, and some of them deserve their own book. But so that's my question to each of you. What subjects or people would have liked to have been in there, what it should have been in there? Or maybe not should, but it would be nice to see them in, book form.
I will start. I will, okay. I'm going to jump in and say that It was tremendously difficult. I mean, some people I'd interviewed, as Issa said, you know, a couple of years ago, when they completely forgot that I was in the midst of writing this book. And I don't think anyone expected, least of all me, that the book would end up, you know, this thick. But it was a tremendously complicated story, you know, with the weaving, the personal stories in with the science, in with the story of fundraising. And I think there were about 150 people mentioned in the book. And I think I interviewed more than 200. And there were so many stories that I didn't get to include, so many stories of patients and their experiences. And everyone has, you know, some wonderful, unique nugget that you really want to include. And yet, you know, my publishers were kind in not making me cut it down further. So it was, you know, it was challenging. Paul got in there though. So did Jeff and Issa.
Thank you.
Welcome, right, Paul. We're so glad you made it.
I'm sorry, folks, but I don't know. That leak didn't work. So,
well I'm glad you're
I'm
here.
Not sure this works either, but you know.
So I'm asking the panelists
right now. I can't hear
right
you.
Now.
So what's happening here? I got to.
Can you all hear me? Okay.
How do I unmute me now?
Here, let me see if I can do that. No, I can't. We can hear you fine. Okay.
We can hear you, Paul.
But he can't hear us, right? Can you hear him, Paul? No.
So while he figures that out, let me just continue with the question then. Issa, did you want to mention like what subjects or people to see?
In the sequel, I look forward to updates about Bijal's Pulitzer Prize and Dr. Wine and Dr. Quinton's Nobel Prize. I hope that comes up. But with all seriousness, I do believe that I'm looking forward to updates on more gene modifier drugs in general from Vertex or other companies that help, like you said, Bijal, the 5 to 10%, especially people of different ethnicities, to be able to be treated with their CF despite its rarity. And also, Bijal, I think by the time certain patients reach a certain age or lung damage, sometimes the modifier drugs do not have the same impact. And so in the sequel, someday I would like to learn more about the impact of lung transplantation on the cystic fibrosis community. And I'm speaking from personal experience. I think there's something like at least 1,500 people with CF alive today because of lung transplantation, and many more have received transplants but are not with us anymore. And that even though that's a small sample of the CF community, it is still a medical breakthrough and technology that we are so fortunate to have, a kind of disease where you can take one organ out and put in a new. Even though we can't benefit from modifier drugs right now, I think it's still an important part of the CF story.
Thank you.
Could I raise a technical point to speak to my colleague, Paul Quinton? Can you hear? Oh, he can't hear me.
I don't know that he can't. He can't hear you. I think he just needs to unmute his computer, maybe. I don't know. Well, okay. Anyway, was there anything in the book, Jeff, a subject that, like we said, in the next one, that that or people, you know, to be recognized?
Yeah, not so much people to be recognized, but what I would like to, the thrust that I would like to see, because Bijal now has a great audience and can reach the CF community. To me, one of the things that we're lacking is getting access to CF parents when their child is first born, when interventions now can make the biggest effect. It's often not until a child becomes sick that people start to get involved with the CF community. And by that time, a lot of unnecessary damage has occurred. So even now with prenatal diagnosis, you would think that would have solved this problem, but it hasn't. So somehow, I don't know how to do it. But this is a wish list, right? So that's on my wish list.
Did you want to add something, Bijal?
Oh, I'm taking notes on all these on the wish list, and there, you know, the one element that didn't get in, which I'm hoping to either do an article or it'll be part of the sequel, is the origin of the gene, and that turned into a very, very complicated chapter. I worked closely with Phil Farrell on that. And in the end, it was just, you know, the book was getting too enormous. So the origin of that gene and the significance of the mutation and the heterozygote advantage of it, if there eventually proves to be one, that's something that I really, really wanted in this book. Couldn't get it in. We'll definitely be in the next one. And, you know, I'm going to continue to follow this story, and I can only hope that I get to tell the story of the 100% rather than the 90%. So, you know, I will, I'll continue to follow it. My kids already tell me that, you know, they don't remember a time when I wasn't working on this book. So I see no reason to change it.
Well, you've left a hell of a legacy. Thank you.
Absolutely. Paul, welcome. And I just wanted to pose the question to you. We were discussing like what subjects or people would you like recognized in I guess we're not joking, because there is going to be some kind another book Mitchell's going to be working on, other aspects of CF. So we're thinking for the next one, what idea, you know, who, what subjects or people, you know, to, would you like recognized? This is our wish list.
Oh, wow. I don't think I can answer that cold. That takes some thought. Michelle has already done such a wonderful job of mentioning everybody. But where do we go from here, you know? And I guess the next frontier is gene therapy, and actually going in and using modern techniques. I mean, we tried it before, but that was long ago. But now things are looking much more promising with CRISPR and the ability to actually get in and, quote, infect the stem cell with the appropriate virus carrying the appropriate genetic information to make the correction. So if that can be done, we can get rid of Trikafta and just go about like a normal people and you know, get colds, sneeze, cough, and get well. So, but who should do that? I don't know. I'm a molecular geneticist, but I don't know any molecular geneticists right off. I guess Labchi Soy is one, but where is he? And well, I don't know. I have to give it some thought, maybe some research, but I guess that's my comment.
Yes. Isa, I do like that though. I like that world of being able to get colds and just get over it and not have to worry so much about it. But yes, Isa.
Thank you. It's good to hear your voice, Paul. Nice to have you on the panel. I'm just going to throw in one more plug for the future book, is to acknowledge and highlight so many other nonprofits dedicated to CF, like CFRI, who have raised money, not at the same levels as the CFF powerhouse, as you called it, Bijal, but have raised money to fund research like Dr. Wine's lab or Dr. Quinton's lab. So, and then there's so many other nonprofits that have raised a lot of money. So I think it's I love the mobilization and the focus of community that you had in your book that was so well highlighted, because I think it does take a village to fight a rare disease. And that village comes in so many different forms. Yeah, I just wanted to add that.
Yeah.
Thank you. I'm sorry. Did you want to add something, Paul?
No, I was just saying that's well said. I mean, it's extremely appropriate and very important. I mean, it's not only a village, it's the entire city, maybe New York and Beijing. But everybody stands on a bunch of other shoulders. So, yeah.
I didn't want to cut you off. Was there something else, Paul?
No.
Okay. I'll go to the first question from the attendees. And Devin Wakefield asks, he says, I wanted to know, Isa, how does it feel that the drug trial you and your twin got into has been helping people with CF for almost 3 decades?
Thank you, Devin, for that question. And I'm so grateful to be on this panel because I'm actually almost 50 years old, born 2 years before Joey O'Donnell. And the DNA trials, I wouldn't be here without them. They really saved my life. And again, I'm so grateful, Bijal, that you featured the first medication breakthrough basically ever, besides antibiotics and pancreatic enzymes. Pulmozyme was the first medication for CF specifically. So it was life altering. I'm happy to say I gained 50 pounds. I think I said that already, Bijal, you said it in the book, but it was something that just saved not only my sister and I, but thousands of other kids with CF.
And thank you to you and to all the people who participated in clinical trials. We wouldn't be here without them. So here's a question from Martin Karazi. He says, Bijal, will your next chapter be the development of newborn screening for CF? For CF.
There is a chapter on newborn screening, a bunch of Phil Farrell's work, and it would be one thing that I would like to include in sequel. You know, don't hold your breath. I will take as long as it needs to, to take to write it. But focusing on the fact that this is not as restricted to a Caucasian population as once was believed. It actually extends to a number of ethnicities. And I'm quite interested in looking into the cases of this in Asian populations. And as an Indian, I'm fascinated by the number of cases that are actually in Pakistani and Indian populations. So that is something I'd like to see. And I'd also be interested in writing about testing within other communities where this could be overlooked.
Very nice. So I wanted to ask you, CFRI awards grants for scientific research nationwide, and it's one of their major programs that they do. And I wanted to ask Jeff and Paul, what impact did CFRI funding have on you and your research?
Jeff, you want to go?
Well, for me, it was total. It was my first research funding. And so it enabled me to start my laboratory, and I couldn't have done it without that.
It was one of the first funding sources that I had. I don't know if it was the very first, but I think it enabled me to get an NIH Career Development Award, which really supported the lab for about 5 years or more. Actually, I guess it was renewed, so it's further more than that, but it was extremely critical, yes. You know, I'm not sure what I would have done without that, because I needed to be supported as a postdoc and then as a research associate, and then they finally let me join the faculty. but anyway, I couldn't praise the people that did that anymore. It was life-sustaining.
Very nice. Here's a question from Siri to Vigil. We touched on this a little bit, but is there a story you heard from your research that was not included that you now wish you had added?
Oh,
there are a zillion stories that I would love to have added, a lot more stories from patients, more of the behind the scenes from Vertex. It could have been twice the size, but you know, I was at risk of demolishing several forests with the length of this book. So I couldn't go that way. But yeah, the history of this gene, that's something that just really intrigues me. And I it bugs me to this day that it's not in the book, but it will be in the next one.
Okay, very nice. So this next question is, and I'm going to apologize for maybe not pronouncing this right, but Vinod Thakral. And it is, CF treatment has already made tremendous progress. I'd like to know, how far are we from curing CF through gene editing or any other mode? I will leave that to whoever wants to answer that.
Oh, I'll just mention there's a program at Stanford now directed by Matt Porteous, who's using gene editing for cystic fibrosis. And it works perfectly well. They can edit the CF gene and make it into a normal gene. The cells then act normally. But the problem is the same problem with the original gene therapy approach, is how you then get those corrected cells to the place that they should be. And so his program is taking the approach of using the sinuses, the nasal sinuses. Because as Issa was pointing out, there are a lot of people with lung transplants who still can have sinonasal disease. And if this works, then by work, I mean if it's successful that the cells can be put into the sinuses and survive, that's a chance that will completely normalize the sinuses. And that would be a one-time cure, but again, only for that limited region of the body.
Paul, did you want to add anything to that?
No, but I would just say that if that's successful, it would be wonderful for transplant patients, because they won't have the constant chronic infection of the nose to threaten the lung and their reduced immune capacity. So it should, it should have a number of very beneficial effects, other than just not having to blow your nose and make terrible noises. So,
let me see if there's. I think there was a question for Vigils. James Curry was curious. How do you happen to be in Iceland, living there? Are you Icelandic? And great talk.
Thank you. I am on vacation with my kids and my parents. And this was planned long before the vacation. So no, I am back in DC on Wednesday. Back to DC.
Back to civilization. here's a question for Paul. Can you describe your breakthrough? And at the same time, Michael Knowles at UNC made parallel discoveries. Can you describe some of those?
Well, I certainly don't want to speak for Mike. I guess what I would say is that the message that I got from Chapel Hill was that there was an increase in sodium absorption. And I couldn't live with that, because I knew that there was a decrease in sodium absorption in the sweat glands. Now, I don't think that makes much sense to people that don't go to bed with sodium and chloride and those kind of things. But anyway, that really was what inspired me to try to show it, clearly in the sweat duct. And it wasn't easy. I mean, I guess I could say that the difficulty of it might be witnessed by the fact that I don't think there's anybody else in the world that's producing sweat ducts now. So it took me quite a while to, one, learn how to recognize these glands in the skin, just to do the microdissection to get to them. And then once I had done that, when we had to sort of steal from some guys in renal physiology, Moberg and Grantham and those guys, who had developed a technique for microperfusing tubules with little glass pipettes. And so I visited Grantham, and he showed me how to set it up, and I took it back, and then we modified it and made it so that it would work in the sweat duct. But that took a number of years too. So I guess I was probably, I started in the early 70s, and it was in the early 80s before we really had it put together so that we could say something that was scientifically credible. So anyway, I just happened to be born at the right place, the right time to go down that road. So.
And we're so lucky for it.
I was lucky for it. I mean, no, really, it's been a great life. You know, all things considered, it's been a damn good life.
Very well. So I wanted to ask all of you, just even though, as Vigil mentioned in her talk, the beginning of CF doesn't begin with the finding the CF, the gene mutation, but it was obviously huge. And I wanted to ask, what did it mean to you, like when that happened, when the CFTR was identified and discovered in 1989, how did that affect you? And I don't know how old you, I was thinking of Issa, you know, I was like, oh no, you're, you would have, you knew that. So I just wanted to ask you about how did that affect you? Issa, do you want to start?
Yeah, I just want to highlight, Bijal, I think you did this so well in your book, of the tension between fundraising for patient care centers versus research. Because what that spoke to me about was when the gene was discovered, of course, I was super excited and super grateful and eager for a cure, but I also knew in my heart that I probably would not be alive for those days. Thankfully, I am alive, but my CF lungs are not. And so I knew that the research, the finding of the gene would embark on a long, long process. And 32 years later, here we are. And of course, it led to so many other discoveries. But at the time, I think, again, that seesaw of wanting funding to go to the research that would benefit people 10, 20, 30 years later, but also funding for the research that would benefit people like me here and now. Support programs, education programs, clinic programs, and so on.
And Jeff, would you like to address
that? Oh, I remember very clearly the tremendous excitement when the gene was discovered, and we all, those of us who were physiologists, immediately started to look for the closest molecular biologist to start to talk to. I do think that, as is often the case in science, that we went astray for a little bit with, we've already mentioned about gene therapy, a lot of work on gene therapy that didn't succeed, and in a way it didn't teach us a lot either. But on the other hand, the fact that we had the gene and then the protein and then starting to manipulate that, that led directly to the drugs that Vertex eventually developed. So you couldn't have done that without having first identified the gene. Might have possibly, conceivably done it, but it would have been a long, much longer road to hoe.
And Paul, can you tell us where were you in 1989 when the gene was discovered, and how that affected you and your research probably?
Well, it's hard to say where I am or where I was. I forget now. But in 89, I guess I was at UCLA. No, had I? I'd moved to UCR. So, and then in 92, anyway, I've been all over. when the gene was discovered, of course, that was a very exciting thing. And I wasn't a geneticist, so I was, frankly, a little bit jealous that these guys were making this great contribution, and I couldn't participate in it really at all. And it was wonderful. And it, I think the thing that in looking back that maybe it did better than anything else is it stimulated so much interest in cystic fibrosis. And it brought, I think, uncountable numbers of people to look at and work on the disease and get involved with what this disease is. It's a rare disease that really made it to Broadway. And the thing that took it there was largely gene therapy and defining the gene, not gene therapy, but defining the gene. So I can't remember, but Vijay, was CF the first disease for which the gene was defined?
They were onto Huntington's, but they hadn't cloned it. Yeah.
And then Tay-Sachs came in there somewhere too, did it not? I don't know.
Yeah. Oh, I think the earliest might have been sickle cell.
Yeah, yes, that may be. Yes, I think that's probably true. Yeah. Anyway, it just drew a lot of attention. And, we went from, in that decade, we went from the cystic fibrosis gap conferences to cystic fibrosis national, international conferences. And, when I started, you would just have a little group of people that met less than 100, and they were basically clinicians that got together and talked about the disease and what could be done. It had very little research support. And it's changed enormously. It's not the same thing. Just in the few decades of my life, not that my life is that few, but in those few decades from 1970 to 1990, it was incredible. So anyway, we're lucky. It happened.
Yes,
and we now have a pill that will almost erase cystic fibrosis. If you're lucky enough to have the right genes.
That's right. So I will ask a question, Julie Desch, and it's to Paul. How did you come to see that bicarb was just as important?
Thank you, Julie. Somebody mentioned bicarb. All the stuff about chloride. And let me say right off that in my view, chloride is not the problem. The problem in this disease is bicarbonate. The inability to secrete bicarbonate in the pancreas causes it to destroy itself. The inability to secrete bicarbonate in the airways sets it up for infections, because without the bicarbonate, the mucus remains thick. So the bicarbonate is really the key defect. The loss of bicarbonate secretion is, I think, the really pathogenetic defect in cystic fibrosis. And fortunately, when we correct CFTR, it also corrects the ability to secrete or carry bicarbonate. So it does correct the chloride transport problem, which solves part of the sweat duct issue in getting chloride in and out of the duct. But the main thing it does is it allows the sweat gland and all these other glands to secrete bicarbonate more appropriately, so that it thins the mucus and it enhances the immune system's defense from invading bacteria in the lung. So, yeah.
Thank you. Siri asks, can Jeff share more about teaching Van Gore from Vertex, how to dissect lungs. And I love this question because I did mention that it was Van Gore's paper that was published because of what he learned from Jeff Wine that allowed me to receive Kalydeco before it was FDA approved for my mutation. So so that's the question. You know, how did teaching Van Gore from Vertex
thank you for the question. It really, most of the teaching, 98% of the teaching was in the reverse direction. It was fate plays big roles, and I was selected to be on this small team of people that worked with Vertex Pharmaceuticals. And that was spectacular. That let me have a front row seat to watch the development. And, you know, I have a lab, a very nice lab at Stanford, just like most academic labs. But then you walk down into the Vertex laboratories and you suddenly see that research has become industrial scale. And just to give you some idea of the intensity and the motivation of those guys, when we would get a lung transplant, the time I remember is that Van Gore and his team made it up to our laboratory from San Diego faster than we got into the lab from Palo Alto. So they were really on top of it. It's not hard to dissect a lung, actually. And they learned very quickly, and they ended up teaching the rest of the field how to keep airway epithelial cells alive for the long periods of time that were necessary to show that these drugs could work. And they did it so well, as you know, that the FDA was able to let them proceed with clinical trials on the basis of these in vitro tests, which was remarkable. No animal models involved.
excuse me. Thank you. Dani Mandela, she asks the question for the whole panel, what is the difference between gene modulators and gene editing? And Bijal, I know in your book that you had a very nice description of this, and I think a graphic, if I'm not mistaken, as well. Is that right?
By gene modulators, are we talking about protein modulators?
I think so.
Okay.
Yes.
So genes make proteins. Genes are the instructions that will ultimately fold out as proteins. And protein modulators actually, you know, if this is the protein modulator comes in and it changes the conformation, changes the structure of the actual protein. It tweaks it in a way so that the protein can work better. And then the other part of the question is gene editing actually changes the genetic code. So it fixes fixes the spelling mistake in the gene so that the gene can make the correct protein. So in one case, you're targeting the protein, which is the end product. In one case, you're targeting the gene, which is the original blueprint. So that's how they differ.
Perfect.
I love those kinds of descriptions in the book. Also, I never would have thought to use some of the words that you use to describe a certain pathway. I thought, oh, that is such a great analogy or just word for how that happens. And so anyway, thank you. That was perfect. Yeah.
You're really talented like that. Your mm-hmm. descriptions of complicated things really come across well. I salute you. So.
The next question is for Bijal, and it says, what will you write about next, and how has your writing Breath from Salt impacted your life?
I think my immediate future is COVID, now that I'm the senior science editor at National Geographic. So that's my day job and night job right now. But I CF is on my list of things to write about, whether it's, you know, magazine articles tend to come first. So I'm going to do something in that realm for CF. And then, you know, I have imaginary book projects brewing in my brain, but, you know, a big shortage of time, like everybody else. But writing this book actually completely changed my life. I don't think I've been, I feel continually inspired by this whole community. When I first started working on this book, Preston Campbell said to me, he goes, you know, you have to understand this is a heroic community. It's not just one person. And as a younger journalist, writing this book, I thought, oh, that's annoying because, you know, I'm going to have these heroes. And, you know, I didn't want to hear the whole, it's the community thing. And, you know, now I sing songs about the community because, you know, it was such a complex story and there were so many moving parts and so many people who worked so hard, that it just, every day I wake up, I think about the people I met during writing this book and the scientists and the patients, and I feel inspired. I also feel like I shouldn't complain as much about anything anymore. But yeah, it's sort of given me a life purpose. It gave me a purpose for 8 years, and I, you know, I'm going to continue to follow every detail. So I hope it's changed me in a way that I've become part of this community, as opposed to just someone who watches from the outside. I hope I've finally infiltrated.
Hey, Joe, you are our historian.
There you go.
Oh.
Yes. Okay. The next question is from Gabriela Castillo. And she asks, how will you go about finding data for BIPOC or people of color with CF, both in the US and globally?
I don't know, but if you have a tip for me, I'm ready and I have my pen here. I think there are a couple of people that I've heard speak talk about the occurrence of CF in these various populations. When I was talking to a patient group that is a local Washington patient group, one of the physicians mentioned to me a group of Pakistani patients in the area. So I think that is my first avenue into this world. And I know that Preston Campbell had plans to go to India, and I told him that as an Indian, he had to take me. He was obligated. Somehow I will get into it. I'm not quite sure how. But like I said, if you have thoughts or ideas or knowledge that you can pass on, I'd be very grateful.
I do.
I'll send you a contact.
Oh, would be great.
Yeah, a colleague of mine, yeah.
And I do have to say that CFRI is now producing videos with various, you know, just diverse, you know, representing diversity in our CF community. And so we have, I know one out already for Southeast Asian community affected by CF, and there are more to come. So stay tuned, I guess.
Okay.
But I'll say. let's see, I guess the next question is for Paul or Jeff. And can you speak to the discoveries of Beata Iliac, who provided early proof of concept in identifying small molecules that target the CFTR chloride ion channel?
Paul, and our colleagues.
Well, I think that she's referring to Beata's work on genistein. Is that correct, Jeff? Would you agree with that?
I would agree, yeah.
Yeah. So, the impact of that was that I think that before she did that and showed that a small molecule like genistein could promote the activity of mutated CFTR, very few people would have had any belief that that could be done, that you could take one molecule and change the function. It's a small molecule, put it together in solution with an abnormal protein and make the thing behave. I mean, that is just mind blowing for somebody that thinks about protein chemistry and function and even channels. So, you know, I think that it was an incredibly fortunate and wonderful discovery or illustration. You see, I don't know how she discovered that. Do you, Jeff?
I don't, but I remember, I don't know if you remember the name Maggie McPherson, but several people were on to this general approach, trying something that would work.
Yeah.
So. And Bill Reinstra, another name comes to mind. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you. The next question is for the whole panel. Do you have any suspicions on where some blind spots still may reside as far as the science of curative and definitive medicine for CF? So blind spots.
I might see it if I weren't so blind.
We kind of talked to some of those, but did you want to add, Paul? Is there something that comes to mind, or?
No, my mind is is blind. No, I can't think of anything that I would. I'm sure it would come if we just sat and had a committee meeting. But I don't know, Jeff. Can you be creative, create something that's.
Well, by definition, blind spots are hard to see. I would, and the way the question was framed was indicated had to be curative. And I think we have neglected a lot of treatments that can tremendously ameliorate the disease and let people, if it started early enough, let people live lives that is all, that are almost as though they didn't have cystic fibrosis, except that they have to do this every day. And we have, so that's not curative, but it sure beats the alternative.
Well, I don't think it's a blind spot, but I think that definitely we need to move in the direction of getting these the drugs that we have to very young children, if possible, to babies as soon as they're diagnosed. Mm-hmm. We can't do that yet, so we have to wait until damage occurs. But if we could do that initially, I suspect that we wouldn't have any of the pathology that we see developing, or very, very little of it.
Issa, the question for you is you work with people and their emotional health and, in particular with grieving, but I know you do a lot of work in the community, just helping those with CF with, depression, anxiety, and other things. How have you seen, how have you seen that change over the years? Or have you seen that change? Is that just the emotional health of those with CF and how to deal with that?
Thank you. I'm the only non-scientist here, but in my mind to the previous question, I'm thinking, is an inflammation a blind spot? But who am I to say? I'm not a scientist. But to answer your question, it's been really a privilege, as I'm sure all of you feel this way, to witness the primary focus on CF going from survival to quality of life. And quality of life includes mental health and also, social and psychological well-being in general, and access and affordability of care. So all of those aspects make life with CF a good life if we are alive and healthy. So it's just been really amazing to see that shift from basic survival, 10 years, 15, 20, 30, to now, how do we want to survive? How do we want to live? So for sure, I mean, I think now we have the privilege of having some of these topics at this conference, like body image or, you know, hearing those issues that are not immediately life-threatening in any sense, but impact our quality of life. So depression and anxiety, I think that's always going to be an issue of those lucky enough to grow older and be more aware of themselves and their capacities and their functioning in the world despite CF. And I think we're losing the stigma around mental health problems. So I think it's wonderful that we are able to talk openly and candidly about the waves of depression and anxiety that hit not only patients, but family members as well.
Thank you. This is for Bijal. Might the sequel also include recent research into the effects of hormones in women with CF?
In all honesty, I'm not completely sure what the sequel looks like right now. I'm still digesting, but the short answer is yes, but that's all I have for you right now.
We're writing it right now.
and I have to put out a greedy plea for, you know, if you have ideas, if you have things that you think I should write about, you know, I'm really easy to find. Just email me, because I would love to hear your thoughts and ideas.
Thank you. You're going to have a whole community after you. So the next question is, do you think, and I'm not sure what this is for, do you think we'll see more precision medicine with CF? And I think the corollary is, do you think, well, maybe that's not a corollary. I'll just stick with that question. Do you think we'll see more precision medicine with CF? So I'm guessing medicines that will target.
I'll try that just a little bit, but yes, I definitely do. And I think we definitely need more precision medicine, because right now we give the same dose of Trikafta to everybody. And not everybody's the same. I mean, we have different metabolism, we have different looks, we have different weights. And that might not be so bad if there weren't some adverse effects. And so I know a number of people who have had psychological, emotional difficulties after going on the drug. One who went on and did very, very well, but the result was so so emotionally stressing that they gave up and just went back to their coughing and said they preferred life like that than life as a miserable, emotionally upset person. So, and there are other things about those kind of effects from CF that we do not, CFTR, that we really do not understand. And that needs to be pursued in research. Maybe that's a blind spot. Needs to be pursued much more in research, and so that we can decide how much to give whom, and what and when and all that sort of precision stuff. Do we need another drug maybe? I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Oh. Jeff, did you have anything to add, or did anyone else have anything to add?
No, I'd strongly agree with a yes.
Can I add something as a non-scientist here? My curiosity revolves around further progress in learning about CF modifier genes, the genes that keep people like Paul Quinton and Jeannie well and surviving long-term. And even if, you might have whatever CF genes you have, that perhaps there's something else going on that's helping you survive this disease. So I guess, Bijal, you could put that on your list. What are the modifier genes that help people with otherwise, pretty significantly bad CF genes thrive into the elder years? And I think I can say that to you guys. Not you yet, Jeannie, but advanced age.
You can.
it's really interesting that you mentioned the modifier genes, because Doris Tolson, who was one of the people I mentioned earlier on, who had a a very strong role in shaping the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation. Her daughter is a, you know, has the double Delta F508 mutation and has done spectacularly since, you know, early life. So after about age five, she's done very well. And people are always talking about her modifier genes and, you know, that she must have very powerful ones. So I think that is a really intriguing area.
So we're getting close to the end, and I just wanted to let people who know who have asked questions that they will be addressed. Somebody will address them probably offline, but I will just keep going until I'm told to stop. But maybe but I at least we have one or two more questions. I think this next one kind of relates to what we're talking about. Crystal Collier, she says, I had a lung transplant and my docs let me go on Trikafta to see if it would help, but it caused my GI problems and I finally had to stop Trikafta. Can you think of a way to give Trikafta in a more targeted way to help my sinuses, but leave my GI system alone, or something along those lines? And it's kind of what we're talking about.
Not a clinician, so I can't speak to that.
No, I can't either. You either eat it or you inject it. And I don't know that one would make any difference on the other, but I don't know if anybody's is taking Trikafta IV, if it's even available as an injectable.
Maybe as a sinus rinse.
But this is an interesting throwback to our earlier discussion of how it would help if you could address the sinuses in people who have had lung transplants.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a big issue. Yeah. Okay, so I've been told the last question. So Francine Beyond asks, what is going to be a primary focus of research to help the older adults for whom modulators are not available? Or even just other people her question is primarily about older adults who cannot take modulators. Do we know? Oh, you stumped everybody, Francine. What's that, Paul?
I can't think of anything specific for older adults. I mean, whatever we do for the resistant mutations would apply to young people as well as older.
Mm-hmm.
However we approach that and what the solution is. I mean, that's clearly a frontier.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thank you. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Issa.
I think, Bijal, I think you just alluded to this in your book, and you can correct me if I forgot the details, but stem cell research. I'm just curious if that would be another focus for regeneration of lung tissue that's already damaged. I'm sure Jeff and Paul know much more about this, but there's just so much, right? There's so much. To imagine that this took you 10 years to write, I'm really excited to think about what life might be in 2031 and where CF will be at that time. And so for Francine's question and for, you know, all the hopes of the 5 and 10% who don't have treatments, I think it's really exciting to kind of look forward to what happens next. Thanks to scientists like Paul and Jeff.
Issa, I think you're a better spokesperson for science than either Paul or I.
I think that's a perfect a close to the session. I thank you all so much. This was just very informative and is just wonderful to hear from all of you who are also distinguished. And I believe I'm going to pass it back to Jim Hampton. Thank you again.
Thanks, Jeannie. And thank you, everybody. And wow, you realize this is just our first two sessions of this weekend and how great this has been so far. So we've got a lot more to go. This concludes our program for tonight. I want to thank you, Dr. Hanley, for moderating this great, great panel and taking care of all those questions. We look forward to seeing you tomorrow. Things get underway at 8:45 a.m. Pacific time, 11:45 a.m. Eastern time. I'm not going to break it down for all around the world. You'll have to figure that out yourself. I'm sorry. Anyway, have a great evening, and we will see you tomorrow morning.
Thank you. Bye.